And the Phoenicians were far from the only people to have sent a fleet in answer to the great king's summons. The Greek spies totted up 1,207 triremes crowded into the ports of Ionia. One simple, brutal fact was menacingly clear. The Allies would be facing a force greater than any that had been at sea. And by land? Only a visit to Sardis could answer that question. The Greek agents hurried on. By their third day of travel from the coast, they could see ahead of them an ominous pall of smoke. Soon they began to make out, dimly through the haze, Sardis itself, the red cliffs of the Acropolis framed by steepling walls and surmounted by Croesus' monumental palace. The banners that flapped over the city's battlements, however, were those of a monarch mightier by far than Croesus had ever been, and the evidence of his greatness, there before the dumbfounded agent's gaze, stretched for miles far across the plain. The smoke they had seen was pluming up from campfires, thousands upon thousands of them from the multitudes of the great king's army. All the spies' darkest forebodings appeared fulfilled. The remotest reaches of Asia and of Africa had emptied themselves. Millions would be pouring in barely a few months into Greece. Or so it seemed. In truth, to count such monstrous hordes was no easy matter, and the spies, before they could even start their calculations, were apprehended. Led stumbling up the Acropolis into the inner depths of the palace, the three spies found themselves, to their astonishment, being personally interrogated by the great king, then escorted on a full tour of the imperial camp. Only once they were laden down with copious notes were they finally sent packing back to Greece. And the reports they took with them, just as the great king had intended they would be, dealt only in terrifying superlatives. What the spies had been shown was nothing less than a panorama of his world-spanning dominions. At its heart, the great king himself and his crack corps of bodyguards, the thousand who attended him personally and bore golden apples on their spear butts, and then a further 9,000, also handpicked, with silver apples on their spears, a shock force of warriors known collectively as the Immortals. For if one of them were killed or fell sick, a replacement would immediately step forward to fill the gap in the ranks. Then elite contingents of cavalry from Persia and various subject nations, Media, Bactria, India, the steppes of the Sarka. Finally, for the great king lacked heavy infantry fit to measure against the bronze-clad hoplites of Sparta or Athens, teeming brigades of spear fodder, who, rolling forwards in a great torrent of humanity, might be expected to sweep away any shield wall standing in their path. This, at any rate, was how it was reported back in Greece. For the three spies, reliant on their own dazzled estimates of the great king's troop numbers, found themselves talking in terms of millions. Such a colossal figure was almost certainly a grotesque exaggeration. Most historians estimate the army under Xerxes closer to 250,000. Even that, however, translated into an invasion force vaster than any previously assembled. Athens was to be burnt, and Greece conquered. For the great king had come at last to the fateful glittering of the Hellespont. Where Asia and Europe stood separated by barely a couple of miles of sea, twin pontoon bridges were awaiting him, their immense cables chaining together the two continents, proof against the currents and the raging of the winds. That winter, it was true, a particularly ferocious gale had swept away two prototypes of the pontoon, but the Persian High Command, having decapitated a few engineers, and with plenty of ships and manpower to spare, had quickly made good the repairs. Even the Hellespont appeared to have been taught to behave itself. The sea had been peaceable ever since. Now, all was ready for Xerxes. His army massed along the beaches and plains of Abydos, the city nearest to the bridgehead, his fleet gliding into the straits. The locals, having correctly gauged the kind of welcoming gift that might prove acceptable to a world monarch, had erected a throne of white marble on a promontory overlooking the awe-inspiring scene. When he arrived, the great king duly took his seat to admire the view. And when he saw the whole of the Hellespont covered with ships, and all the beaches and plains of Abydos filled with men, Xerxes counted himself truly blessed. 7 days in all it took the task force to pass from Asia into Europe, and the achievement, to those who witnessed it, appeared to be the work less of a man than of a god.